So what I'm going to do is to talk about what we've learned in terms of stigma and then how this relates to what we need to do in terms of improving population health. Okay, I don't have any, I'm a sociologist, I don't have anything to disclose. we're the poor, you know, neighborhood. And okay, so let me start with the public health relevance of stigma. And Ron, again, alluded to this, that in terms of the global burden of disease, if we think about coronary vascular disease, you know, the global burden, Murray and Lopez number, is 14.7. Well, neuropsychiatric disorders are right there. And yet if you look at the resources we devote to coronary issues and the ones that we devote to mental health issues, there's just no question whatsoever. And in terms of decreased life chances that Ron mentioned as well, we not only have evidence from the United States that we have this, on average, 25 years decreased lifespan if you're treated in the public health system, but we also have data from places like Denmark, where one would expect, and it is, less, but it's not eliminated. So 16 to 18 years lost if you have schizophrenia, and 12 to 13 years if you have bipolar disorder. By 2020, I think that we'll see that the leading cause of disability worldwide is depression. And the 1999 Surgeon General's report, which I might add is an indicator itself of the stigma attached to mental illness, since the first Surgeon General's report was in 1960, having to do with cardiovascular disease and smoking, that it's one of the foremost obstacles to recovery in terms of thinking about behavioral health issues. I'm just putting up, there are a lot of sources of support for all the research that I'm going to be talking about today, and there is a long list of collaborators, some of whom are in the room, actually sitting right there in the front seat, and our Columbia University partners, and more growing all the time because a lot of these data are public data that can be used by lots of people. Wanted to talk a little bit about the use of the General Social Survey, which is the longest running monitor of American public attitudes, values, and opinions and behaviors. And a lot of what I'm going to be talking about today is based on the vignette strategy that was used in the 1996 study, which Margaret alluded to, in terms of being one of the first national studies in 40 years. And we've done a number of these. All of these data are public. Okay. So let me start to make sure that we're on the same page. I take this definition of from Steve Hinshaw, the mark of shame, as he calls it. And of course, everybody who does stigma always somehow puts up this slide. So I didn't want to be different, right? I wanted to be right in with the normative sense of the crowd. So stigma is a mark possessing an attribute that basically devalues, dehumanizes people, and subjects them to prejudice and discrimination. And after Goffman's work, there was a lot of interest in understanding the nature of stigma, particularly in the United States. And that lasted until, I would say, like the mid or the late 1970s, early 1980s. Now, there are some in the room, and I have to point to Bruce Link as one of these people who, carried the standard of stigma research forward through that lull. But there was a lull. But by the time that happened, there were a number of things that we already knew. We knew that stigma was prejudice and discrimination, and this was very much tied into the early work done on racial prejudice and discrimination. We knew that it was real. We could enumerate it qualitatively and quantitatively. We knew that it harmed individuals, not only physically, but also in terms of issues like self-esteem, in terms of issues like social exclusion and isolation. We knew that this trickled down, one of the few places where trickle-down theory ever worked, into reduced funding for research and treatment infrastructures for people with mental health problems. And that, as I mentioned, that Bruce's modified labeling theory, along with his colleagues, showed that the label was very powerful for stigma, but it is not really where people, sort of became chronically mentally ill. So one of the things that happened, one of the reasons that sociologists lost interest is because there was an argument between two leading scholars about whether or not it was the behavior associated with mental health problems that caused people to want distance, or whether or not it was the label that was imposed and all of the social baggage that went with it. And they kept arguing this, but they didn't have any data, and it sort of got, after a while, boring to sort of just read, no, it's this, no, it's that. The other thing that happened on more the public health and in particular psychiatry side is that people associated deinstitutionalization, which was a major improvement in how we thought about mental health treatment, with the demise of stigma. And so as late as 2004, I was reading articles in the psychiatric literature that said, now that stigma has dissipated in the United States. And I had just spent 9 months in the two largest psychiatric units and the two largest hospitals in Indianapolis. And I have to say, I didn't see much evidence that stigma had dissipated. And that sort of led me, I'm a health services researcher, so you heard from two epidemiologists, but I'm the person who's in the treatment centers, and I'm saying to myself, I don't see that this has disappeared. And so in trying to understand how people get into treatment, the pathways that they travel to treatment, I decided to think about, now that we had shown that that really matters, I wanted to think about what was in those networks that made a difference. And so I said, well, let me go find out about stigma, having been trained, you know, with Goffman and all. And so I went to find contemporary literature on stigma, and I found modified labeling theory and some other important pieces. But basically, there most of it had dissipated with that. And so that's when I called Bruce at Columbia and said, we have to get a national study done. We have to see where this is, because if nothing else, we have to refute the claim that stigma has dissipated in the United States, or prove or show where it has dissipated and how it has dissipated, because that would then be a really important opening to understand all kinds of change in the cultural climate of care. So that began, I don't know if it was that, because it also happened in places like Germany and Canada and Australia and New Zealand, in the UK, that all of a sudden there was this interest in stigma again. And so I've labeled that the resurgence. And the questions of the resurgence really focused on these questions here. Has it dissipated or has it not dissipated? What are the roots of stigma? What has been the change in terms of thinking about issues of mental illness, given the focus on the Human Genome Project and on the whole omics revolution? Are PSAs useful or are they not useful? This is a huge argument in terms of thinking about how to deal with getting people into care and thinking about the treatment of people in society who have mental health problems. What does the global landscape look like? I mean, you pick up any psychology and psychiatry textbook and you will read that individuals do better in developing societies as a result of the International Studies of Schizophrenia. That, I think, is a valid conclusion, having talked to Kim Hopper more than once about this. But I think that the conclusion that people take from that, which is that people in developing societies are kinder and gentler than people in first world, so third world, first world, global south, global north, all of these terms are politically incorrect, but nonetheless, we know what we're talking about. So looking at the global landscape of stigma, and then thinking about where should we target our public health intervention efforts. Okay, so some of the lessons from the resurgence. Is that the public is more sophisticated and more open, and that, you know, when you asked in the 1950s what is mental illness, you got mostly answers having to do with psychosis. Now you get a whole range and whole spectrum of things that the public understands are mental health problems. However, stigma is alive and well, and one of the things that we saw in the earlier session is that the more intimate the venue you're asking about, the higher levels or the more people report stigmatizing reactions. And there also is a difference in terms of the particular kind of symptoms that people have associated with those little boxes in the DSM. And so we found that, you know, it's very different in terms of how the public reacts to depression than it does to schizophrenia, than it does to alcohol disorders. And there's a difference, you know, people say, well, people don't think there's anything out there in terms of what can be done for mental health problems. But no, Americans are aware of what's out there and they think they work, but they're not willing to use them. They want you to use them. They don't want to use them. We've seen also that sociodemographics are not particularly potent factors in understanding who stigmatizes and who doesn't. And that turns out to be very important, because one of the first things that you hear is that individuals, you know, who are more educated are going to be less stigmatizing. Not true. Okay. So stigma directed toward kids is less than for adults, except for depression, and that the Shefko debate turns out to be obsolete, because guess what? It's both the behaviors that are different that give differential levels of stigma, and if they label it a mental illness, that does as well. Okay. So it turns out that it's the belief system that really pushes what happens with stigma. It's not the socio-demographic characteristics. People get neuroscience. They believe these are genetic disorders, but in fact, that does not translate into lower levels of stigma. As Joe Phelan has showed, there's actually a genetic backlash in stigma to issues of, if you believe that it's caused by a genetic problem, then you say, I really don't want those people to marry into my family. And I think this is important in terms of the argument of where we should target. It turns out that the larger cultural context has a direct effect on people's willingness to use services or suggest other people to have services, and it also affects self-stigma. So if you live in a society where there is more public stigma, you feel more self-stigma, you report more incidences. And this is just a demonstration of the fact that we have had change in the United States in all those red circled areas with regard to changing attributions. They get it. It's about neurobiology to a large extent, even though psychiatry has moved away from the chemical imbalance. And they've gone away from the social things like bad character, except for alcohol. That has become more stigmatized over time in terms of that, but absolutely no change in stigma. Okay? With regard to the ISOS that I mentioned, we looked at 27 different variants of stigma in 16 countries. We looked at all the measures of sociodemographic inequality that we could think of in terms of level of development, and we took into account the factor that looks at how many correlations you have run, so the false discovery rate. And here what we find is that there was not a single correlation that supported the idea that in the global South stigma is lower. There were a number of correlations that supported the idea that it's actually higher in third world developing global South societies, and most of the correlations didn't either. Now, I don't want you to leave depressed. And so it turns out that countries that spend more on public health are also likely to have lower levels of stigma in their population. So it does look like there's this general influence of population issues that we can take on in terms of dealing with this. Okay, well, it looks like we're going to skip these. But can we reduce stigma? That's one of the other issues. One of the interesting things about stigma is that people really like public service announcements. And so what you have is good people spending a lot of money producing public service announcements. But the question is, do they work? And most public service announcement campaigns are not tested. What I was trying to show here that didn't come up is that we were the first to look at What a Difference a Friend Makes campaign, and show that of the three different PSAs that were produced, only one, the Friend campaign, had a dramatic reduction and significant reduction of stigma. We also have now turned to testing these before they're finalized, and we've done that for Bring Change to Mind and their schizophrenia PSA. And the other thing about it that turns out to be really important is we used a national survey design, and we coupled that with a laboratory cognitive science design where people are hooked up to Barker lounges, and it turns out got the same answer. So the point that again, like Ron said, this is not something I can go into, but the point is that stigma is part of a complex population system. And we have to be very aware that if we hit it at one level, it may pop up in another level. And so what we need is a long-term, consistent, multi-level issues that are, or intervention that deals with many of these different characteristics, and we see these in school things. So I think some of the next steps we have to follow is to do some conceptual clarification, to do continued monitoring of the American population, to deal with what's called the spectrum issue in terms of what about if somebody has recovered in the vignette, does that change if they've gotten treatment, does that change? We have to sort of fundamentally think about the message that we need to put forward with regard to stigma and reconfigure strategies, focus on real people, real experiences, and real effects so we can get those outcome measures, and to think about new directions. And if you were at the last session, you heard about the focus on schools at K through 12. We are focusing with Bring Change to Mind on the college level because every place that there's a critical transition for people, that is a point at which they are reconfiguring their sense of self. And so that's a point at which they can we can push the refresh button on how they think about mental illness and how they think about stigma. Thank you.
Thank you.